You got to do it, baby, she said when I was through. All a man got is his sense of what's right and what's not. If you know you've been done wrong and you know how to make it right, then you don't have no other choice.
Her dialect veered back toward its Mississippi roots when she was being serious. I've always known, I argued.
But no one else ever gave you hope or a name,
Grandma countered.
And before, you had more important work to do.
Detective work?
No, fool, she snorted. Asia Denise. You had to see her become a young woman before you could take care of yourself. That's just mother wit.
I didn't say anything because she had said it all.
You want to come have breakfast with me in the commissary?
She asked. Sure. 11. Roger Ferris joined me and my grandmother for breakfast. He was a year or two younger than she and 6 feet, even at that great age. He was lanky and crowned with a mane of silver hair, a reminder, no doubt, of his nearly limitless wealth. Grandma Brenda seemed to enjoy his company. I guess the breakfast table was exempt from date status. Roger was a gun enthusiast and a pacifist, too.
Any person who learns a deadly art,
he told me over chicken sausage and egg white herbal omelets,
whether it be competitive boxing or sharpshooting, must be held to a higher standard. I mean, a man with a semi-automatic can kill a dozen people faster than he can utter their names. That's a crime against God.
That's why it's so hard being a cop, I said with a nod and a sip of decaffeinated coffee.
How do you mean?
The man worth $879 billion asked. There you are, I said, out on the street with your piece and people who might be armed. They're afraid of you, mad at you, wanting revenge for something one of your other brothers in blue might have done. But still, you got to keep your pistola holstered because you have the power and the responsibility. Roger smiled at me and nodded. I could see that guns, for him, were a symbol for the power of his wealth. And for that brief moment, he saw us, even if not exactly as equals, somehow as the same.
Your grandmother is a wonderful woman,
Roger said to me at the elevator door. He had wanted to walk me there, and my grandmother seemed to approve. Has been for a very long time.
She says that you had to quit being a cop because you got into some kind of trouble.
Trouble ambushed me with my pants down and my nose open. I didn't know why I was so candid with Ferris at that time. Now I understand that he radiates a kind of confidence and the feeling that he could be trusted.
Brenda said as much,
he said, nodding.
She's amazing. Very intuitive and completely free of guile or greed.
She says that you want to take her to a concert.
She told me, not unless I can get a better tan.
She wants to go, Mr. Ferris. You keep up the pressure and she will, sooner or later. Ferris smiled and gave me a clear view of his pale blue eyes. They were sad eyes. I imagined that soon he and my grandmother would be sitting side by side at some fancy concert.
When you went to the can, your grandmother told me that you might have some trouble coming up.
You know grandmothers, I said. Sometimes they get overprotective. Well, the billionaire replied, placing a hand on my shoulder.
She's right. You'll just give me a call. You'll find that there's not much in this world that scares me.
He handed me a business card and gave me a nod. Late November still had its warm days that year. I stood out on the street composing 5 emails on my smartphone. I'm a little obsessive about electronic communication. I reread each communique at least 3 times and then put each one through a spell check. After finishing, I went to the C train, riding it downtown back to Brooklyn Heights. I dabbled around on the internet for a while looking for keywords that included Adamo Cortez, arrest, police officer, and testimony. It was 10:07 when I finally dialed the number. Hello, a man said. Mr. Summers, I asked. Yes. This is Joe Oliver. I believe that you know about me. Hold on. The phone's receiver clattered and Then came the sounds of children expressing happiness and complaints. I heard her voice before she got to the phone. It sounded nothing like the woman I remembered, begging me to pull her hair.
Hello?
Mrs. Summers? It's Joe Oliver.
Yes, I was expecting your call.
Somewhere on the other end of the line, a door slammed, and the noises of Midwestern early morning domesticity ceased. To begin with, I said, I want you to know that I appreciate your letter and what it means. I know you didn't have to reach out.
Thank you, but you're wrong there, Mr. Oliver. Since I came back to the church, I've thought about all the bad things I've done. Some of them there's no coming back from, but in your case, speaking the truth is the least I can do. When would you like me to come to New York?
Let's talk about that a little later, I said. First, I want to ask you some questions.
Okay,
she said on a sigh. You said in the letter that you had been arrested and then coerced into pressing charges against me by a man named Adamo Cortez?
Yes.
This man said that he was a policeman?
He was a policeman,
she corrected.
A detective.
And he was the one who arrested you?
No. I was picked up with my boyfriend at that time, Chester Murray. They brought me to the station house on 135th.
The 32nd precinct?
I don't know, she said. But it was on 135th. I remember that it smelled like disinfectant.
They all do it sometime or other.
I guess they must, she said,
trying to let my poor attempt at levity in.
I don't remember the names of the officers that arrested me. Chester was driving, but I had leased the car. There was 20 pounds of cocaine in the trunk. They took me to this room and wouldn't let me talk to Chester or call a lawyer or anything. They didn't even let me go to the toilet.
Beatrice went silent there for a minute or more. I knew what she was thinking. If a cop wants to turn an arrest into an agent, he puts a scare into him. Or in this case, her. Hunger, humiliation, and hurt are the tools. Not all worked on every perp. You had to create a specific cocktail for the personality. For Beatrice, it was fear of isolation, maybe a little withdrawal, and a bladder so full that she had to relieve herself without benefit of the facilities.
I was there for at least a full day before Detective Cortez came to see me.
She was once again defeated by the illegal methods. This reminded me of Rikers, and the burn on my face when I was slashed by the jagged edge of a number 10 tomato can lid. After another long pause, she continued.
He said that they could hold me for 2 days more without pressing charges, and by then Chester would have turned on me.
You think he would have? I asked. I don't know why.
Yeah. Chester once gave evidence on his cousin just so they wouldn't put another mark on his record. He wouldn't even have gone to jail, but he turned Jerry in anyway.
What did Adamo look like?
Short for a man. Black hair with a pretty thick mustache. His skin was brown like a brown egg if it was shellacked.
Did he have an accent?
I don't remember.
What did he say?
That I'd get a year in prison for every pound in the trunk.
A sob escaped her reserve.
That I'd never have children, or even a chance at a decent life.
And, I deduced, I was the price to get you out of it.
Yes.
Did he tell you exactly what he wanted you to do?
Yes.
What to do in the living room? What you should tell me to do? Everything?
Yes.
That time, the word hurt. And did you really go so far as to press charges? I asked, wondering why I wasn't angry.
He had me transferred to another station. There, he gave me some papers to sign.
What then?
He took me to a house in Queens and kept me there for a week. I was in restraints most of the time. He raped me.
And then he let you go? I could almost hear her nodding.
Yes.
Beatrice and I shared the next spate of silence. I could hear her breathing over 1,000 miles away. Do you remember anything else?
No.
Are you planning to press charges against Detective Cortez?
I hadn't even thought about that. Isn't it too late?
Yeah, but you could fuck up his retirement pretty good.
I know you're upset, Mr. Oliver, but could you not use that kind of language, please?
Sorry.
Why do you want to know if I want to press charges?
The guy you were arrested with was named Chester Murray, I asked, instead of answering.
Yes.
Did you see him again?
Never.
Was he your pimp?
That was another time, Mr. Oliver. When do you want me to come to New York?
What makes you think I want you to come out here?
To testify. To prove that you didn't do what they said you did.
I don't think I need you for that, Mrs. Summers. You gave me a name and a trail. That's enough.
Really?
Yeah.
So that's it?
Unless you remember something else.
The thing you asked about, Detective Cortez.
What thing?
He had an accent. It was a very New York kind of talking. You know what I mean?
I certainly do. Thank your husband for me, Beatrice, I said, and then I hung up. 12. I was deep into the cases, and not even a day had passed. I cleared off the desktop in my apartment, and on a pink sheet of paper, I wrote, "Someone in the department was definitely involved in the false accusations against me. At the 32nd, a man named Adamo Cortez, posing as a detective, coerced Natalie Malcolm into pressing charges against me for rape. Correct spellings and her testimony are attached below." After taping Beatrice's letter at the bottom of the page, I placed the pink sheet in the center of the green blotter on the empty desk. This simple act sent a thrill through my scalp and shoulders. Finally, it had begun. Leaving the excitement on the third floor, I took the trapdoor rope ladder from my apartment down into the office below. I usually take the hallway stairs between floors, but that morning felt secret, outlaw. There was a pulley system to roll the hemp rungs back up and a long pole kept in a far corner to close the trap. I sat at the window in my private office and stared down at the working-class pedestrians being shown up and disdained by the street. I didn't say or do anything but ponder for the next couple of hours. I hadn't had much sleep because my mind could not shut down completely. The lack of sleep and deep disposition of mind caused a descent into a fugue-like state. There was no me, but just the details of future blue and pink pages. There was an eggshell with a mustache and a ranger with a pistol in his hand. There was a dark hole that seemed to hold intelligence, and a girl child all grown up. The phone pulled me out of the temporary retreat. "Hello," I answered, maybe a little dreamily. "Joe?" I was still in that faraway place. The voice was familiar, but nameless. I groaned, and the vibration brought knowledge. "Hey, Henri. Yeah, it's me. I must have dozed off. What time is it?"
3:30. What kind of shit you into, man?"
"How's your father?" I asked, while trying to remember the email I sent that morning.
"Adamo Cortez," my caller insisted.
"What?" I said. And then, "Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I called in and said that there was a guy saying that he was a CI for a detective Adamo Cortez. They said they never heard that name. It wasn't in their files. But a few hours later on, two suits from one police plaza came down to the street to see me. The street, Joe."
"What'd they want?" I asked, the void receding behind me.
"They wanted to know everything. Everything. Where I met him, what he said, was it near a video camera?"
"What you say?" I asked, almost fully back to normal.
"I just made shit up. Said I was doing a foot patrol in Central Park, which I was, and this guy comes up and tells me that I should tell my superior that Bato Hernandez has to make a drop. He said to say that he needed to speak to Adamo Cortez, that Cortez knew how to make contact."
"What'd they say?"
"They wanted a complete description. What the guy wore, how old he was, and everything else. They even asked if anybody saw us."
"They wanted an eyewitness alibi?"
"Yeah."
"Were you ready?"
"You're the one told me that I always had to be ready with a lie, Joe.
that I should have one all worked out in my head because you never know.
I must have told 100 cops that, Henri. But you're one of only two that took me up on it. I'm sorry, kid. I didn't think you'd actually call in like that.
I tried the database,
the Haitian cop replied.
He just wasn't there. Not as a cop, a CI, or even some suspect. Nowhere. But I thought that if somebody called it in, then they might look in some secret database that the uniforms don't know about.
With a question on your lips and a lie in your pocket, I said, in admiration. You know, there was something I never taught you, kid.
What was that, Joe?
That sometimes you can be too smart.
So, what are you into, man?
Is this a safe line? I asked, way too late.
Payphone in the lower level of Grand Central. I'm surprised these suckers still work.
Don't worry about what I'm doing, Henri. It won't do either of us any good. But tell me the names of the suits.
Inspector Dennis Natchez and Captain Omar Laurel.
An inspector, I said. Damn, did they give anything up?
Not really. They threatened me with a review. Said that I should have detained the suspect. But I said that he wasn't a suspect. That all he did was to say to ask a question. And anyway, I thought he was crazy.
He spoke as if he were arguing with the brass, showing that he was a good cop, a good liar. Nothing else?
That's what Laurel asked, Henri replied. When he did, I asked, like what? And he asked, did the guy give any other names? I told him that French was my first language, but that I had excellent English, except for all the foreign names. At one point, I said, he asked me to try Guy's Witch or Toucan, something like that.
I grinned at my desk, thinking that the kid would be a great detective one day. And did he come up with a fit? I asked.
He said, Cumberland?
Too smart by half, I said. Listen, man, forget you talked to me. Drop the whole thing.
You're not gonna tell me what it's about?
Your father once told me that the day after you were born, he bought a pistol. He said that he'd never needed one before, but when he saw you, he knew that he had to be ready to die for his son.
That's my dad. Good luck, Joe. Call if you need me.
One email answered, and four to go. My second email was sent through a remote router that stripped off any electronic connections to me. I identified myself as Tom Ball, an investigator working for parties interested in the disappearance of Johanna Mudd. I knew that Braun had set a meeting with Mudd and that when he didn't show up, she disappeared. My sources, whatever those might have been, had informed me that he, Braun, was investigating the conviction of the cop killer, a free man. I went on to say that I needed information about his case in order to see if his enemies were also against Ms. Mudd. That was a long shot, but I thought I might at least have electronic communication with the lawyer celeb, gathering a few crumbs in the process. At 4:14 p.m., Asia Denise walked in. I was sitting at the reception desk, considering the tips of my left hand's fingers. My teenage daughter wore a red dress that was barely acquainted with her upper thighs and white vinyl platform shoes that elevated her to near my height. The green straps of a backpack dug into her bare shoulders.
What?
She asked me. Are you wearing anything under that slip?
Daddy.
I held up a lecturing finger and said, just think if you walked in here and all I had on was a T-shirt and a pair of those skin-tight satin trunks that those men were wearing at Sunset Beach. Because, girl, that would be overdressed compared to what you got on right now. The thing about me and AD is that we know what to say to each other. She shifted a little uncomfortably and placed her arms in such a way as to cover some of her flesh.
Everybody dresses like this.
Answer my question.
I guess I wouldn't want that,
she agreed.
But if I go all the way home, I won't be able to work for you today.
What you got in the backpack?
A trench coat?
Put it on. She opened her mouth to protest, but I opened my eyes wide, and she took off the incongruous drab green backpack instead. The trench coat was light tan and short-hemmed. She put it on, fastening all the buttons and tying the sash around her waist. The coat wasn't much longer than the red slip, and it fit her like a dress suit. But at least there was something left to the imagination. You know, we're gonna have that talk someday soon, I said.
I know.
She gave me that wry expression, inherited from her mother. I love that child. During my most difficult years, it was only her and Gladstone who never let me down. The buzzer to the door sounded, and A.D. went to answer. It was the in-person reply to the third email I dispatched.
Hey,
Asia said with real welcome in her voice. She backed away from the entrance, exposing Willa Portman, wearing a simple and mostly shapeless black and orange dress and a pink sweater, and carrying that same briefcase.
Hi,
she said to all and sundry. Miss Portman?
Mr. Oliver, I hope I'm not interrupting.
No. Asia and I were just discussing the office dress code. She told me that I cannot wear a wife beater to work. Willa smiled, and I gestured for her to enter my office.
Want me to come take notes?
A.D. asked. No, I said, before closing the door. I see you got it, I said to my unlikely client when we were seated.
$19,250, and a pretty nifty briefcase, too.
Pretty nifty, I parroted. Where are you from?
A small town in Ohio called Martin's Ferry.
The poet James Wright is from there.
Who?
Never mind. I read a lot of those files you left. It's certainly suspicious, and I can't see why a lawyer of bronze caliber would back down. So I'll put the money in a safe place and use it until the case is solved, man is dead, or I decide that he's culpable.
Thank you.
Are you still working at Braun's office?
I plan to quit tomorrow.
I don't think that's such a good idea.
Why not?
Before I could answer, there came the haunting notes of Clair de Lune by Debussy. Instantly, I had a button on the intercom that would mute any sound and turn on a red light on Asia's desk. Then I took a burner phone from the top drawer, and as I picked up the phone, I put a finger to my lips for my client. I pressed a button on the side of the burner for the reply to the second email of the day. Mr. Braun, I said.
Mr. Bull.
I was hoping that you'd call. I'm really stumped with this case.
Who are you?
A private detective working with a concerned group over the disappearance of Ms. Mudd. No one has heard from or seen her in over a week, and we're very concerned about her welfare. She has diabetes, and her grandchildren depend on her for child care.
There's nothing wrong with Ms. Mudd,
Braun said in his most reassuring, most dissembling lawyer's tone.
No one knows her whereabouts because no one needs to know.
I don't understand you, sir.
It's not for you to understand. Just take my word when I tell you that Johanna Mudd was in danger, but now she's someplace safe.
Even her daughter and son don't know how to reach her?
It's better for everyone that they don't.
I can't say that to my clients.
Her son and daughter?
No. An interested third party.
This is a very delicate situation, Mr. Bull. You must give me your clients' names so that I can assure them myself, and so that I can impress on them just how important secrecy is.
I took the appropriate six beats to pretend to be considering this action. I can't just hand over my clients' names, I said. But I will meet with them and tell them there's more to the case than I at first thought. I'll tell them that you're willing to meet.
I need to meet with you too, Mr. Ball. We have to talk.
About what? Willa was staring at me with a fearful look on her face.
The phone is not a place to share secrets. Do you know Liberté Café on Hudson?
Yes, I do.
Meet me there at 7:30 tonight. I believe I can convince you of the need to keep this quiet.
I can't make it till 9:30, I said. Got a few important emails to catch up on.
Okay,
he said, quickly, too quickly.
9:30. I'll see you then. How will I know you?
I'll have a red pansy in my lapel, I said, before disconnecting the call. When I returned the phone to the drawer, Willa asked,
That was Mr. Braun?
It was.
You told him about what I said?
I sent him an email informing him that I was Detective Tom Bull, private, and that I was working for certain concerned parties who wanted me to find Johanna Mudd. He knows that I know about the Free Man case, but that much is in the papers.
Did you say about him dropping the case?
No. She sighed. But he may suspect that I'm getting information from inside his office, so the best thing you can do is stay on the job. If anything comes up I need to know, I'll give you another number you can call me on. The young lawyer gazed at me, realizing for the first time, I believed, how deep in shit she was. She nodded, and even forced a smile.
I guess this is what I asked you for, she said.
You want we should drop it? She searched my eyes for the answer. After a good long time, she said,
No. I never really knew how much a man can be a victim of the law until I met Manny. He's a killer, but he's no criminal. I can't turn my back on that.
I gave Willa the number of another burner I owned, and then showed her to the door. I stood there, staring at nothing after she'd gone.
Did Mom do something to you?
Asia asked from behind me. Yes, I said to the door.
Did it have to do with me?
I turned to look at my trench-coated blood. She looked at my files.
How do you know that?
I can tell when people look at certain files. I lied. Files you never opened before.
That's not really so bad, is it?
Asia asked. No. But from now on, don't take work out of the office, okay? She nodded, and that was enough. 13. Asia was gone by 6:30. I dressed and was ready for the night by 7. The last talk I had with my daughter had put the trouble with Monica to bed, but I forgot, as most men are wont to do, that what happens to me is not necessarily up to me. Upon exiting the door onto Montague Street, I heard a man shout, Oliver! The street was crowded with shoppers beginning to think about dinner and Christmas and who felt that they should be outside before the bite of winter sent them home for the season. A group of young men and women, mostly black, were fooling around near the curb. From around the 20-something revelers came Coleman Tesserat, Monica's boy toy husband. He was dressed for jogging with the hood down. The sweatsuit was yellow, with dark blue or black piping. I had a short-nosed .45 revolver in my windbreaker pocket, but that hardly seemed necessary. Later that night, things might be different. Coleman, I said. A sky-blue-haired black girl watched us. She heard the threat, as I had, in Coleman's voice. What did you say to Monica? He demanded. Why you want to ask me that, and you already know? Coleman got to within 24 inches of me. He was a black belt in some Eastern exercise system and thought that taught him how to defend himself. I asked you a question, he said, with all the confidence of the dead. I said, you already know. The blue-haired girl touched a young man's shoulder. I'm not afraid of you, Coleman was saying. If that was true, I said, still looking at the girl, you wouldn't be in my face.
I could kick your ass right here, Coleman warned.
In front of witnesses, I said innocently. And me with my hands at my side?
Stay out of my business, he said, understanding that he'd made a tactical error confronting me like that.
Did your wife tell you why I said I'd look into you?
It doesn't matter.
She called a man I was investigating. If he was of another nature, I might be dead. She was fucking with me for no reason. I just pushed back. And the next time you come at me, be ready to kill, because I won't stop coming till it's over. I walked away with all kinds of nonsense racing through my body and mind. Teenage hormones sang in my heart and sinews because I wanted to beat Monica's new husband to pulp. Under that feeling was the revelation that my preoccupation with the opposite sex had returned. I knew this when I saw blue hair looking at me. I was ready. There's an illegal private club on Avenue D down near Houston. It takes up the 3-level sub-basement of a huge public housing project. You push the button for apartment 1A, and the buzzer lets you in. You come to the door and say a name. If they like the name, you go through the door and down some stairs, coming to another door. This opens to a very large room that is quiet and usually half-filled with men and women who need privacy on the level of a secret society. There are comfortable chairs and tables, walls lined with bookshelves, and servers wearing either tuxedos or miniskirts.
The residents of that building never complain, because the owners of that nameless club have at least 3 security people watching the entrance at all times. There's no mugging, drug dealing, or prostitution above the basement. Ever. I had not been to the club before, but I knew of it.
Looking for Mel?
Asked a lovely, blonde, black young woman standing behind the cast-iron podium at the bottom of the stairs. She wore a little black dress, black hose, and a micro-chain silver necklace that had a red stone as its jewel. Yes, I am. She took me through a doorway behind the podium, down a slender hallway to another flight of stairs that led to another large room with fewer occupants.
At the opposite wall, she said.
I saw Melquoth Frost waving at me from the place the hostess indicated. I couldn't help feeling that I was actually about to make a deal with the devil. He stood up when I approached the table. I got the impression that this was a show of great deference. We shook hands. His powerful paw felt like a winter glove filled with concrete. Mr. Frost?
King, I got your text. Did they let you in like I said?
They sure did. We sat and appreciated each other a moment. He wore a lemon-colored suit that was loose but hung well. The shirt was lapis, replete with errant silver and golden threads weaving through. I wore a felt-lined brown trench coat, black trousers, and black leather shoes with rubber soles. I had 13 years on the force, 6 of those as a detective, and Frost was the most dangerous criminal I had ever come across. Our few meetings had convinced me that he felt in my debt, though we had never discussed this obligation after his first visit to my office. We might have been about to start speaking when a mid-height, slump-shouldered man wearing a white jacket and black pants walked up to the small round table.
Mel, the man said in a voice that was hard and clear.
Ork, who's your friend?
Nobody for you to worry about.
A guy up at the bar told me that he looks like a cop he used to know.
Go back to him, Mel said, and say that he should mind his own business.
Mel and Ork peered at each other maybe a quarter of a minute. The latter's nostrils flared, then he walked away.
Friendly place, I commented.
Crooks are a skittish lot,
Mel countered. I thought you gave all that up.
I just like the atmosphere. Sometimes you get the need to talk to people who have the right language behind their eyes.
I nodded.
What can I do for you, King?
Tell me why you came to my office that day, I said simply.
I told you already.
Maybe pad it with some details.
Why?
Because I might want to ask you for something, and you're named after Satan. Melquoth Frost grinned.
I saw a red bird in Prospect Park 2 days before you busted me, he said.
A red bird.
Pure scarlet.
He assented with a vigorous nod.
At first, it was just a flash up in the trees, in between the leaves. But then it landed on a branch maybe 40 feet away. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. I found myself hoping that it would get closer so I could get a better look. I was sitting on a park bench, getting my head together for the job. The thing took wing and landed on the lawn in front of me. It was big, almost the size of a crow, and there was a single black feather on the crown of its head.
There was what I can only call a beatific look on the ex-heist man's face. And, I said.
He looked at me, and I knew that that meant something. Here's some completely wild animal comes right up to you and looks you in the eye. That means something.
He had me.
What?
I asked.
I wasn't sure about the exact message, but a bird means freedom, and the color red means pay attention. And I thought that a bird like that, a bird that stood out like a flare in the night, was something like me. And then, when the prosecutor asked you to say something about me that would throw me under the bus, you refused. You were the better man when I was running, and again, when I was helpless. Don't get me wrong. I could have done my time. I wasn't afraid.
But you weren't either. You were like that red bird in the tree. And then you came down. That was the sign. As clear as the nose on
orc's ugly face. I was committed to one more job, and, like I told you, my partner shot me in the back. That right there was the final straw. The business was finished with me.
I was convinced that Mel was crazy, but his psychopath's vision of the world seemed cohesive and certain, something I could trust to be what it was. I'm involved in a couple of cases, I said after an appreciative pause. I'm going to need some help, and I thought maybe I could hire you. I got a small budget and could hire a man. It's not heist money, but you're not a heist man anymore. You got it. Don't you want to hear what it is? Sure, you got to tell me, but Mr. Oliver, if that red bird asked me to follow him, I would have said yes, too. How much will you charge? $1 now, and $1 when it's through. I took a dollar bill from my wallet and handed it to him. You want to take a walk with me? I asked Melquoth Frost. He put the dollar in his breast pocket and stood. I followed him up the stairs and out into a fate filled with madmen and redbirds, nameless cops and women who fooled you again and again. 14. Walking across from the East Village to the West was a pivotal, even a transitional journey in my life. My father was a criminal, and therefore I had become a cop. I was framed and threatened, and so stopped being official and did the work as a private dick. Every step I had taken was an equal and opposite reaction to my father. You might say that it had nothing to do with free will at all. But me walking down those chilly autumn streets with a man so evil that no crime deterred him meant that I had taken the first steps on a different path, a path that was mine and mine alone. I know there's no way for me to make up for what I was, Mel was saying as we made our way north on Hudson. The dark brick of the old buildings imparted their gloom onto his lecture and our destination. I mean, I did it all, and it doesn't mean anything. Maybe if I felt it, I would want to make amends. He kept talking, but I wasn't listening too closely. I knew somewhere that this was new for him, too, that he wasn't the kind of guy who told you anything unless it was either absolutely necessary or a lie. Melquoth, maybe for the first time, was thinking out loud, while I remembered my cell in solitary and how my enemies had broken me, made me cower like a dog. There it is, I said after 6 long blocks. The Liberté Café was on the east side of Hudson, having big windows and outside tables that only a few people used. It was mainly an overpriced pastry shop that made complex coffees and little sandwiches that pretended to be French. Can I help you? A young caramel-colored woman asked. She had big freckles flanking her broad nose and a space between her front teeth. How about that table there? I suggested.
Sure, I'll get Juan to bring you menus.
I could see that Mel would have preferred a table tucked away behind the counter, but I knew that such seating would make us look suspicious. Juan was a smallish, bronze-skinned man with a debonair mustache and eyes that had somewhere else to be. I'll have the prosciutto on a baguette and a green tea latte, I told the young man when he asked the floor for my order. Coffee, black, with some bread, Mel said. When Juan went away, Mel asked, So what do you want with this guy? Referring to Stuart Braun. Have you ever met him?
No, but I knew a dude in Q that Braun got out from under a murder one charge.
Braun was in California?
No, but the guy had killed somebody in New York and then another man in Sacramento. California extradited and convicted him after Braun did his magic out here.
I don't want to say why I'm looking into him quite yet, I said.
It's your dollar.
I was beginning to like my satanic sidekick. So what's your story, Mel? I mean the real deal. He looked at me. His eyes were truly dead. But regardless of that, there was gratitude in his stare. Prison psychiatrist says that I have borderline personality disorder with intermittent psychotic breaks that both relieve the pressure of unconscious guilt and make me dangerous. That sounds crazy. Don't it? I asked the woman.
If I was that far gone, why was I in prison and not in some mental facility?
What does she say? I asked, looking up to see a trio of unlikely customers walk through the glass door. The big men all wore jeans, cotton sports jackets, and patterned shirts of various styles.
Their modern law in the United States was based on economic class and what the popular opinion classified as evil,
Mel said, answering my question.
She said in the modern world, a man who beats his own head against the wall is crazy, but the guy slammed somebody else's head is criminal.
Three guys walked in, I said. I see him in the mirror.
They were talking to the sweet-skinned, freckled girl. The fat one in the light jacket is a guy named Porker, Mel added. I don't think he knows me. I was supposed to kill him this one time, but his girlfriend decided that she felt sorry for his wife and gave me my 50% kill fee.
The men were looking around. Finally, they decided on the partially concealed table that Mel coveted. When they were settled, shy-eyed Juan went over to take their orders.
So your story is a prison psych putting a textbook diagnosis on your actions?
I asked, telling Mel that we were just going to watch and wait.
No, I was just giving you the official answer. You know, that's how most people know everybody else. They read it in a newspaper ad or maybe a letter from home.
So what's the real answer?
My mother was a Catholic girl. From the age of 3, she went with her mother to church every Wednesday and Sunday. When she was 9, she pledged her life to Jesus Christ and each and every word in a single book. Then one night, when she thought she was alone in the cathedral, a man dragged her into the confession box and raped her. She was barely a teenager. And right there in the church, too. That shit warped her brain. Her mother and father ordered her to get an abortion, but she told them that that would be against God. They kicked her out of the house, and she lived in a Catholic dormitory where she gave birth, named me after the demon, and never, ever showed me any love. I was a duty, like Job's trial for her. She housed me and fed me and told me every day that I was the son of evil.
I looked into Mel's dead eyes, thinking that my life might not have been as bad as I thought.
You know Porker's real name? I asked. I forget, but I know where to get it.
After that, we dallied over our drinks and food. Mel had a vast range of knowledge that had nothing to do with crime. He knew quite a bit about evolution. He told me that his greatest wish, when he was a child, was to change into something different, like wolves had become dogs or dinosaurs, birds. When my watch said 10:37, the three thugs paid their bill, got up, and left. They hadn't seen the man with a red flower in his lapel. Stuart Braun wasn't there either.
I guess we can go too, I said, maybe half an hour after Porker and his crew were gone.
Outside the restaurant, Mel said, I killed the motherfucker. The old me would have been on the alert for a confession, but I'd already crossed over that line in the East Village.
Who? My father. I asked around until I heard about a guy from my mother's old neighborhood who had gone down for rape a few times. I met him in a bar, and after a whole lot of rye, he told me about a 13-year-old girl he raped in a confession box. He said that was the sweetest nut he ever had. A little later on, I made some excuse to get mad and hit him in the teeth. I wiped some of the blood up with a handkerchief and left him on the street. The DNA lab identified him as my father, and I met up with him again. He'd been so drunk that he didn't remember getting knocked out. I took him to this abandoned house in the Bronx and put all kinds of pain to his ass. When he was dead, I poured 17 gallons of sulfuric acid into a big old bathtub, and that motherfucker was gone from the world. It was like he never even existed.
Because he raped your mother? I had to ask.
Because he made me, and made me what I am, and didn't even know it. And on top of that, he wouldn't have given a damn, even if I told him.
15. I took a yellow taxi home. Montague Street was empty. Coleman Tesseret might have been hiding in some doorway with a gun in his hand. Maybe the exposure of his crimes on Wall Street would have salted him away for 20 years. I didn't know. I did know that I wasn't afraid to die. That since deciding to go up against the men who took my life away, I had no fear.
King, baby, she said.
Turning my head to the left, I saw Effie Stoller, 5'3", with 15 pounds over what her physician would have called perfect weight. She had big lips and skin darker than mine. Her high, high heels might as well have been bare feet, she was so poised, and her hair had been done into the shape of a seashell that would exist in some far-flung future when humanity had devolved itself into geologic memory. "I know I'm a little late," I said, as she walked up to me. "I thought you'd be gone." She kissed me full on the lips and said,
"I knew you'd get here. If you emailed me, it had to be something hard."
Effie had been a prostitute in the old days when I had a beat. She was run by a pimp named Toof, who came from somewhere in the Midwest. He worked her hard and beat her regularly, but she never complained or turned him in. Then late one Wednesday night when I was on the street in Midtown, an older woman hobbled up to me and said that she'd heard a shot from a building I knew well. On the top floor, a door at the far end of the hall was ajar. There had been as many eyes on me as there were roaches in the wall, but nobody came out to tell me anything. It wasn't that kind of building. Inside the apartment, Toof was on the floor in his ivory-colored gabardine zoot suit. The left side of his skull and most of its contents were on the wall. Effie sat 9 feet away at a dinette table in the tiny kitchen. She was drinking the good cognac from the bottleneck, something I was certain Toof would have never allowed her to do. The gun was on the table. It was a huge six-shooter, .41 caliber. I picked up the piece and sat across from her.
"When I woke up this morning, I knew he had to die," she told the tabletop.
"Why is that?" I asked.
"He got a new girl. Pretty thing."
"And you were jealous?"
"The first time I seen him hit her, something changed. It was like I had died, and the gatekeeper was showing me my life. He gave me a chance to go back and fix it. All I had to do was get a good night's sleep to figure how."
Toof had done all kinds of bad things, and Effie had always been, more or less, easy to work with. If I busted her, she took the arrest with style. She deserved better, and he'd gotten exactly what was coming to him. Toof had a back door to his tenement apartment. I helped Effie to her feet and told her where she could go for the night. Then I put the .41 at the back of my pants and called in the homicide dicks, as was my duty. Effie was my fifth email of the morning. I knew I'd be needing some comfort when it came to sleep. She undressed and bathed me, gave me an oil massage all down my spine to the middle of the gluteus maximus. When that was through, she turned me over. Her breasts and stomach glistened from the oil.
"You're not hard, King, baby. Don't you like me no more?"
"I thought maybe we could try and talk for a while," I said.
"What you need to talk about?"
"You know how one time you told me that you woke up in the morning and knew what you had to do?" We had not discussed that night before.
"Yeah,"
she said with a slight nod and a steady gaze. "I woke up a few days ago." She laid down beside me and put her hand in my chest. We stayed like that for long minutes.
"I stopped tricking 6 years ago," she said.
"Then why are you here?"
"I knew what you was feeling after they lied on you. I knew. And when you called me, I came because that's what a woman does when a man saves her life. He don't have to love her or care about her or nothing. But if he save her life, then she gots to take care on him. And even though I'm a professional and fully legit masseuse now, if you call, I'll come over."
"I guess this is the last time I'll call," I said.
"We could still get drinks or something,"
she offered.
"Now turn over."
The new massage was softer and ranged wider. She did my earlobes and between the toes, the webbing between my fingers and the big tendons of my feet. All the while, she was singing something, but I couldn't quite make it out.
"Daddy?"
I hadn't been in a sleep that deep for a very long time. Not since before my days in solitary had I slept well at all. A few hours here and there was the most I could hope for, but that day, with A.D. shaking my shoulder,
I woke from slumber that had been completely given over to rest.
Yeah, baby.
Have you been asleep all day?
What time is it?
A little after 4?
I sat up, keeping the blanket wrapped around me. Asia was wearing a light brown dress that came down to almost the knee, and though it revealed her figure, it didn't cling. Looking at this mature attire, I realized that she was even more alluring and looked old enough to do something about it. I chuckled to myself, realizing that I couldn't keep my chick in the egg.
What you looking at, Daddy?
Fate.
Are you okay?
I thought about her question and finally said, sit down. She perched at the edge of the bed and cocked her head the way she had as a child.
What?
She asked. I wanted to say that watching you grow into a woman is really the best thing I've ever done.
I talked to Mama, she said.
Oh?
She told me what she did. She tried to say that it wasn't all that bad, but I said that she couldn't have no idea what might happen if she outed you like that. I think she understood.
Go on downstairs, I said then. Let me get dressed. 16. Even with waking up that late in the day, the afternoon was almost normal. Asia made phone calls and filled out checks for me to sign after she was gone. I looked down on Montague Street thinking about Effie, pretending that she was a hooker in order to give me what I needed, and Mel flying out of hell in the guise of a scarlet bird to be my guardian angel. I intended to use Willa's money to pay for a full investigation into Stuart Braun's case on a free man. But first, I had to make a little headway on the frame certain elements in the NYPD had hung around my neck.
Angles and dangles.
A woman with a deep and raspy voice answered on the fourth ring. It was 6:30, and Asia was packing up to go. Let me talk to Marty Moreland, I said.
Oh?
My friend Marty said he'd be at the bar and I could call at 6 sharp.
To begin with,
the woman said, peeved.
It's 6:30, and even if whoever you said was here, you gotta call the payphone you want to talk to a customer.
She hung up, and I smiled.
What's so funny?
Asia was standing there looking at me from the doorway. I like my job, I said.
You working on that thing for Miss Portman?
I surely am.
You scared Coleman the other night.
Oh, really?
Him and Mama been talking about it every night after they think I'm asleep. She's wondering what he did that you could catch him on.
What does he say?
I can't really hear what he says. He whispers mostly and she shouts. But you know what, Daddy?
What's that?
I think you should find out what he did and turn him in.
I looked closely at my daughter, at the dark place in the light of my life. She turned her head in a pose of absolute seriousness and came in to take one of the Ash client's chairs. She wanted me to know that she wasn't kidding. Something about the gravity of her gaze lightened my mood by half. I can't do that, baby.
Why not? You know, Mama get all mad about you and that woman, but she was seeing Coleman when you were still married. I saw a letter from him to her that was written a year before they put you in jail.
She had good reason, I said, admitting my own sins without naming them.
But it was him who told her to leave you in jail.
How do you know that?
One time, when she said that she felt sorry for the time you were in jail, he said that they had talked about that when it happened, and she made the right decision to cut the cord.
That almost got me. I might have done something if I didn't know that Monica needed no help abandoning me. Are you spying on your mother, A.D.?
She did it to my computer. She'd go through my stuff all the time.
Well, I don't want you to do that anymore, I said, managing to put some weight into the words. And I would never send a man to prison, not unless it was my job.
But what if he deserves it?
Doesn't matter.
Why?
Because I've been there. I know what it's like, and I'm just not that evil. She sniffed and looked at me, learning as she did so what her father valued and what she might be
I'm going to Melanie's house tonight, she said after a long lag in the conversation.
Studying?
Just to get away from that house.
Your mother knows?
She mad, too. She mad at you and now at Coleman. All she ever wanted was a life like they live on the TV, and all she ever got was the front page of the Post.
It was something I said from time to time. I laughed, and she snickered. We got up at the same moment to hug each other goodbye. Angles and Dangles was a dilapidated bar about 8 blocks from the old Navy Yard. There were a few small neon signs in the dirt-caked windows provided by defunct beer companies. Inside, nautical knick-knacks like life preservers and big oak ship wheels hung, leaned, and sat on shelves here and there. Some of the men who drank at the bar and the few tables along the walls might have been seamen at one time or another. The rest had been dock workers. The woman behind the bar, Cress Mahoney, was the heavy voice that had hung up on me. She was faded, but still lovely at almost 50. Her graying hair had been brown. Her blue eyes had a spark to them. Everybody was white in there, and they all noted my skin color.
You still make that grog with lemon juice and water?
I asked Cress when I bellied up to the bar.
Do I know you?
She asked with a sandpaper larynx. I only ever ordered from Pop Miller before today.
You knew Pop?
She was doubtful.
Knew? Is he dead?
The question hurt Cress. She loved the old guy. I liked him myself and hadn't heard of his passing. The only reason I called the bar was to make sure that it was still there after so many years.
Heart attack, fishing out on his rowboat, she said. They didn't find him for 3 days. He floated half the way to Delaware.
He left you the bar, I stated.
What do you know?
That Cress Mahoney is the finest woman on the eastern seaboard. She could gut a fish or spear a shark better than most of your so-called seamen.
I approximated his accent well enough to convince her of my half-truth.
What's your name?
My father named me Thor after a comic book he read one time. She'd never heard of me, but still smiled at my imagined christening.
And what do you want here?
Grog. I knew her lover, athwart Pop Miller, and more about her history than I was willing to say. I had turned Pop into my CI when I found out about a regular marijuana delivery that he ran down at the docks. I didn't interfere, but instead made him identify and then report on little Exeter Barrett. Pop didn't like Exeter because he dealt in heroin. I had a deep interest in the ferret-faced runt because he could lead me to the biggest bust in New York City history. I only ever came to the bar after hours, so Cress was unlikely to know my face or anything about me.
I don't recognize you, she said.
Pop and me used to play Go after he closed, I said. He told me that his clientele wouldn't like a man of my shade playing Chinese checkers at his bar.
Addie tried to teach me, she remembered aloud. But I just didn't get it.
They say Go is harder than chess. Pop said he picked it up on a tour of Southeast Asia in the Merchant Marines.
And why you think I own the place now?
She asked.
He's got 3 kids and 2 ex-wives.
But only one lusty wench, I quoted, that he wanted to be marooned with in the South Pacific. The tension went out of Cress then. I could see in the mirror behind her that her clients were losing interest in me. America was changing at a snail's pace in a high wind. But until that gastropod mollusk reached its destination, I had a .45 in my pocket and eyes on all 4 corners at once. Cress served the sweet rum drink, and I savored it. I was reading an iPad version of the story of Joan of Arc, looking up now and then to see the denizens of an old way of life bring their world back for a night. There was an old-fashioned jukebox that hadn't had its contents swapped out for 30 years. Brandy was a fine girl, and she'd have made a good wife, but his woman was the sea. Maybe 2 hours later, a man said,
"Hey, mister."
He'd installed himself on the bar stool to the right before I looked up.
"Yeah?
Do I know you?"
His skin was wizened and burned brown from ocean-going sunlight. The eyes might have had a color other than brown,
but he squinted. I smiled and turned Joan off.
"Why do you ask?" I replied.